Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Need Some Introduction. As you can hear in the background there, we have the theme song to Bluey, available on Disney Plus in the United States. For our UK and Australian listeners, you've already had this show available to you for quite a few months now, and we actually do have quite a few listeners there in both places. But for the rest of us and the majority of our listeners, we're finally getting this new third season of Bluey in about a week, actually. And there were no really big premieres this week, and I'm on vacation, so I had to pre-record a lot of this content. So I did want to spend some time recommending Bluey. Sona and I have both recommended this show separately in the past, but I haven't really spoken about it in great detail. But I'm about to make some quite hyperbolic statements about Bluey. Oftentimes on this show, like we just basically had a musical moment last episode discussing Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska and its songs about serial killers and criminals. And later in this episode, I'll be catching you up on another serial killer story, the Blackbird show on Apple TV Plus, which is wrapping up next week. Which is to say that when you talk about prestige television, critically acclaimed content, whether that be music or movies or TV shows, oftentimes the material is very dark. Even Better Call Saul, which we're covering here, obviously, week to week, which is approaching its finale here with three more episodes to go, is pretty dark content, not only in terms of violence, but this dark family dynamics and relationship dynamics that we've seen in the most recent episodes. So I want to spend some time telling you that one of the absolute best shows on TV, I'm not saying this is one of the best kid shows on television, or whatever we call television now, considering everything's streaming. I'm telling you that the show Bluey, if you haven't seen it, is one of the greatest shows ever put on television. Now, if you are a Bluey fan, I am preaching to the choir. You already know, and you've probably tried to get other folks who are not parents to watch this show, or even if they are parents. But this isn't just a great kids show. This isn't just funny if you're a little kid. This isn't just a way to keep your kids occupied, because of course they will suck this show up, mainline every single episode they can get their hands on. I just mean straight up, this is one of the greatest television shows ever put on television. And it does a great amount of good. The show is about an anthropomorphized family of dogs, two girls, and their parents. Each episode is only 7 minutes long. But what is so incredible about this show is that every one of these little 7 minute masterpieces, really masterpieces, are a little world all of their own. So many times when you watch kids shows, you are watching a show that is catering to them. It's just giving them pretty colors and childish jokes. That's all fine and well. I'm a fan of the Captain Underpants style of slapstick humor as much as anyone else. But Bluey is the extremely rare show where whether you are a parent, whether you're a grandparent, whether you are a child, you will watch the show together. You will all laugh at the same joke at the same time. So this is not like Shrek, where you're making a completely inappropriate double entendre that they can't get, and meanwhile they're laughing at fart jokes, which you probably don't like as much as they do. It's not that kind of DreamWorks animation recipe. It is something much closer to Pixar at its absolute best. But it even does something that Pixar can't do, which is to have this beautiful emotional payoff and have these perfect little stories told in just these little 7 minute increments. I get very frustrated when my daughter can watch a 2 hour movie and she oftentimes will prefer to watch short videos on YouTube. I feel like it's almost stifling their attention span. But here's an example of a show that is short, but perfectly calibrated. It's not just a meandering, useless 7 minutes of content that ends randomly. It has a beginning, a middle, and end. It's beautifully written. The vocal performances are great. Speaking of music, which is something that I'm going to try to drop into each one of these segments this week, since I don't have a full music segment, it has beautiful musical moments in all of their episodes. And we listen to the Bluey soundtracks, the compilations that people have put together on Spotify. And not only does my daughter listen to these classical music pieces, usually classical, but also other types of music, and immediately remember the specific episode of Bluey from which they're from, you too will remember those moments. So if you have a child, they should be watching this show because it is something uplifting and affirming and way more intellectually nourishing than the average cartoon or Nickelodeon sitcom that they'll be consuming. But more important than that is there are moments in those episodes that teach life lessons to these kids in ways that they can comprehend. My daughter will literally have moments in real life where I'm kind of reprimanding her for something or trying to teach her some life lesson or explaining why I made a decision that I made. And she will reference the Bluey episode because it's almost like priming her for these circumstances in her day-to-day life. As a parent, as I am a parent watching this show, it is not only something that makes you appreciate being a parent, despite all its frustrations and everything else that a parenting can be, it will honestly make you appreciate being a parent more. And more importantly than that, every single episode, practically every single episode, has a fun family game. So if you get unable to find entertaining things to do with the kids, they come up with really clever games you can play with your kids. And your kids will request it after they watch the episodes. Hey, let's play Keepy Uppy. Let's play some of these games. Let's play Magic Xylophone. So it's inspirational to be like, hey, I can do that too with my kids. And by the way, you don't even have to come up with your own games. You can just replicate what they're doing on Bluey. So it's an incredible tool for raising your kids. It's an incredible tool as a parent. But much more importantly than that, there are plenty of shows that kind of have this good for you. They're good family medicine. But the show is just so beautifully made, so emotional oftentimes, and also absolutely hysterically funny. And the incredibly, incredibly rare thing where every generation, you can be 5, you can be 12, you can be 35, you can be 65, and you're all laughing at the same joke at the same time. An incredibly rare feat. This is something that I literally have never seen any family entertainment be able to pull off successfully. And Bluey pulls it off with ease. The worst Bluey episode you'll ever see is one of the best episodes of television you'll see that year. And the best episodes of Bluey are some of the best TV you will ever watch in your lifetime. I do not think any of that is hyperbole. This show is brilliant. And I hope it lasts a very, very long time. And it's becoming incredibly popular. I can only imagine what the ratings will be like when it finally premieres here in the US season 3. There's a lot of anticipation among the Muppet set. So if you haven't caught up with it, even if you don't have kids, by the way, I guarantee you, even if you don't have kids, you'll love this show. So I recommend it to everybody, and it's my highest recommendation, one of the true masterpieces of the last decade of television. And that's Bluey, season 1 and 2 currently available on Disney Plus, and season 3 coming in just about a week, a little over a week now. And my daughter can't wait. All right, for the rest of the episode, just a bunch of bits and pieces of things that I have pre-recorded, conversations I've had recently. I was originally planning to have a full conversation about all the announcements for the upcoming Marvel shows and movies and what this might mean. We just had Comic-Con last week, and they've just announced an incredible slate of films coming and TV shows. And it gives me a lot more confidence that what seemed to be meandering in the current state of the MCU was actually intentional, since this current Phase 4, as they call it, which is wrapping up with the Black Panther film, was really just table setting for the next phase, which is going to be about the multiverse. And Kang will be bookending that entire series, and it's a 2.5-year cycle, which includes, I don't know, at least 12 movies and at least 6 or 7 TV shows, maybe many more than 7 TV shows and projects. So it's a pretty incredible slate. Will they be able to pull it off? I am interested in seeing this giant grand experiment that Marvel has. But to dig into that, I definitely want to bring in Ray and Nick to have that conversation. So that may wait until next week. So I'm just teasing it here, but do track down. I'll include an article here that kind of breaks down all of the upcoming projects, and we can discuss what that might mean for the MCU in general. In the near future, we will be covering She-Hulk, at least in some part. I'm curious to see how this very comedic take on this character, A, whether they can pull it off or not, and B, how it might tie into a broader MCU context. We do have Bruce Banner, Hulk, in this series, so I assume it will tie into the grander MCU at some point in the future. Make sure you subscribe so you know when all that content becomes available. We are currently wrapping up or approaching the finale of Better Call Saul, this last 3 episodes. Very, very exciting to see how the show is going. A very interesting episode this week, which seemed to be closing a chapter on part of the Saul story in a very quiet and muted way. Not totally satisfying to me, honestly, but I assume there is some grander story that is being set up here that I may not be fully understanding. But I have a lot of confidence in these folks. If you haven't listened to our most recent conversation about that, make sure you track it down. It just came out this week. We spent a lot of time talking about Cinnabon, as you would expect if you've seen that episode of television. And of course, next Tuesday, expect to see our next recap. As for the remainder of this episode, my sister and I discuss The Gray Man. We review that Netflix show, which I found very satisfying at incredibly low stakes, but satisfying nonetheless. And I have additional conversation about my confused reaction to Jordan Peele's Nope, a very, very ambitious and often successful film that nonetheless didn't leave me feeling satisfied and did make me worry that Peele is maybe overcomplicating his films thematically. And at this moment, I am curious to see how he can course correct, in my opinion, in the next film. And also, I'll be giving you a brief recap of this most recent episode of Blackbird and kind of catching up on the season for all of you who have been watching that show or who have not caught up yet. And I do highly recommend you do catch up. We will be discussing the finale of that show in next week's weekend episode. If you'd like to support the show, make sure you subscribe. Make sure you recommend us to your friends and family. And if you haven't already given us a review or a rating on your podcatcher of choice, please do tap the 5 stars or whatever grade you'd like to give us on your app of choice. It really does help people discover us. I do appreciate when filmmakers use their platform to bring attention to music that might have been overlooked. And one such track that's been getting a lot of traction recently, based on its use in The Gray Man, is Silverbird by Mark Lindsay. Mark Lindsay being the lead singer of Paul Revere and the Raiders. This track, a solo track of his, never achieved the heights that many of those Paul Revere and the Raiders tracks did. I think it barely cracked the top 40 in the UK and in the US, and is now being resuscitated by this Gray Man film, this giant, expensive production from Netflix. This is a mildly entertaining film, but one more positive in resuscitating this surprising lost possible hit, which is now finding some audience. I know you saw Nope, and we should definitely talk about that, but that might be a longer conversation. So maybe we start off with what I think is going to be a pretty light conversation, but the Russo brothers, who directed the two most recent Avengers films, part of the brain trust that runs these MCU properties, and they're still going to work on some of the Avenger movies in the future, but they've taken a little bit of a break. And they started off, believe it or not, Celia, they started off directing and writing on Community. And from Community, they went into making those Captain America, films. And then the Captain America films did so well that they were handed the reins to the Avengers films. And of course, those last two Avengers films are like two of the most popular films in history. So massively successful. And now they have this deal with Netflix, and they have gone and made the most expensive movie ever for Netflix. And it shows. And that movie's called The Gray Man. And we both watched this, didn't we?
Yes, I just saw it.
I gotta say, I really was only gonna talk about this because it was obviously hugely popular, but I wasn't that enthusiastic to see it. And the critics had been pretty down on it in general. And I have to say, it is not a very good movie in like, it's not dense with themes or it's not fascinating with subtext or the performances aren't there to get nominations at the end of the year. But for what it is, which is just a big, loud action movie, I had a lot of fun with this. I thought it was totally fine.
That's what I thought. Fine. Is that a compliment, yeah, though? It's good. It's fine. I see like what they were trying to do, and they did a really good job at that.
Yes, exactly.
And I was entertained.
Yes.
And I didn't ask a lot of silly questions, although I could, especially like, how does this little girl not die with all this commotion going around her, considering right, she's got a pacemaker? But see, I only thought about that here and there, because the rest of the time there's very, very good action.
Yes.
And I like that it's international, mm-hmm, and yep, it's all over.
Yep.
So It's fun to watch. I feel like I'm watching some postcard action. I do like that. But is it like complicated? And I mean, there's like a little, there's hints in there about his relationship with his father, which is very brutal. So that was interesting. There's not a lot of that. It doesn't really leave you with any questions
No.
except for the continuing non-dying of this little girl.
In the final moments, it feels like it's setting up a series. And I am pretty sure they're planning to set this up as a series, especially if it's successful, which it seems to be so far. I do think, how do you increase the stakes here? It's funny. I was reading some reviews just to see like why people were so down on it. And literally, this extremely negative review said that there's nothing to differentiate this action movie from any other action movie you've ever seen, other than two of the most memorable action sequences you'll ever see. And I'm like, that is valuable. I'm sorry. Once again, I agree that from a script perspective, from a character perspective, all been done before, totally agree. But having two of the most memorable action sequences that I've seen in years, I am going to rewatch those action scenes. I'm not going to rewatch the whole movie, but I will rewatch those action scenes. And that is, in my opinion, that's good if that's an action movie. I'll take that.
This movie is like easy breezy.
Yes.
This is what Carlos calls movies he likes. He doesn't like all that tension and horror. I like that. He likes easy breezy. And this is that movie. So it's fun to watch. There are stakes, so you have some investment in it. But it's a little bit like a cartoon. It is definitely not the Bourne series.
No.
It's not that good.
It's better than the last Bourne movie, by the way. That last Bourne movie is terrible, so it's better than that.
Well, I don't know about that. But I for what it and I knew what it was before he even turned it on. I'm like, I already know what this is going to be and I'm fine with it.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're like, it's fine.
The defense I'll make of it, by the way, in some of the things you just said, is that when I go see a James Bond movie, and by the way, the most recent James Bond movie I think is better than this movie. I do believe that. But regardless of that, the simple fact is that when I go see a James Bond movie, I'm not surprised by what happens in that movie either. But people give that positive reviews, and like I think this is no worse moment to moment, and oftentimes better in some scenes than like your run-of-the-mill James Bond movie. I mean, this is way better than Quantum of Solace, for example, which is awful. So I'll take this over that any day of the week. I do like the most recent James Bond film. And what I would say is one huge missed opportunity is that Ana de Armas is so much fun in that new James Bond movie. She's the new 007, and she's just like on her first mission, and she's just having a blast. And I feel like this version of her in this movie is like the boring version of that character. I'm like, I'd rather see the other character than this one.
James Bond movies are better. The timing's better. This was a lot of action and it was very good action, but it just kept going and going. There's not like the pause. So you can really take in the scene and the outfits and the, sky. It doesn't have that timing. So it's like one thing happens, then another. And you just want to see if he can survive all
Yeah,
this, but
it's just being shot out of a
that's
cannon.
what it's like.
Yeah, I mean, but I would once again direct you to not the best of the James Bond movies. Like I said, I would take even the most recent James Bond movie, which is not the best of them at all. I will take it over this film.
Oh,
But
yeah.
once again, rewatch Quantum of Solace or don't, because you won't make it through. You'll make it about 45 minutes in and you're going to give up because that movie is terrible.
No way. It is not terrible.
Quantum of Solace is terrible. It's the worst.
I did not feel that way about Quantum of Solace.
Agree to disagree.
Okay.
Another couple of questions on there are I was like, is this possibly in the same universe as Ryan Gosling in Drive? Like, is there a version of this universe where guy Ryan Gosling in between these big missions maybe was like on the lam and he just kind of like settled in as a driver in Los Angeles and he is the same character that he was in Drive.
It could be that he leaves all this chaos behind, but because people are still after him, he changes his identity and becomes the guy in Drive.
Yeah, exactly.
This
It
could be
could
a
this could be a
prequel to
prequel,
that.
right? Or it could be in between, right? That, you know, he got out of jail. We see that flashback, and now it's like whatever it is, 10 years later, whatever they say it was, 20 years later, I think, supposedly. So in the interim, there was a moment there where he was like not working for this agency, and he was just kind of on his own for a while.
I like Ryan. He's very attractive.
I,
I
you know,
like his surly personality in both of these movies. It's very mysterious. I'd be like, what are you thinking? And then he would give me a one-word wise-ass remark, and that would be so charming to me. Like, ooh, he's so witty. So I like him.
for me, he didn't work here. And I think he was one of the worst things about the film. Not that he's terrible, and not that I don't like him or appreciate his that version of charisma he has. Because, for example, I like him a lot in Drive, and he barely speaks in that movie. And I like him a lot in La La Land, where he is, you know, like a neurotic mess, right? And this is kind of the two, those two characters mixed together, which is very strange, but that's kind of what it is. But I didn't love him here. I think he was one of the performers that didn't match the material. But what I did like about him is I do think that when he is in action mode, you know, it's kind of the same way I felt about Robert Pattinson, who I did not like his performance in that Batman movie. But I felt like when he was punching people out, he was totally convincing, like physically in the role. But, you know, he gets really quippy and he's got this like heart of gold for this girl. But then he's also like literally just at that moment, he can like kill everybody in the room because he's also a cold-blooded psychopath. I go back to the idea of Drive, where he is a cold-blooded psychopath and we don't even know what's going on inside his head, but he wants to be a better person. And here he's just like, I don't know, like I can't get a read on him at all. Like he's is he this completely damaged sociopath, or is he really like a nice guy? And you know, it's not very well defined, I would say, in general. And I don't think
I
he
think he's a nice guy who has to protect himself against, I guess, his past. So he's blocked off a lot of his emotions. He's very focused on fighting and on this child who's like the main reason everybody's running around in this movie.
I mean, maybe it seems a little bit of a stretch for me when you think about how he's able to, you know, dispatch like 25 people without any qualms. That's he had to have planned out though, like a massacre many times over, which I don't know, doesn't make kind of takes away any of that kind of cuddliness they're trying to
Where does he
imbue
get
him
these
with.
skills too? Like, he didn't just
Exactly.
have them.
Exactly. That's the most ridiculous thing of this whole entire film, is that they picked him out of jail because he killed his abusive parent, right? And somehow he has become not only a 007 type character, like a trained killer, but like someone who you can send 100 of the best of these sociopaths at him, and he will take them all apart without an issue. By the way, like just to speak to the point that when it's him and Chris Evans, until Evans pulls out the knife, that like he is just completely dominating him, right? So it's like, where, how did Billy Bob Thornton just see this guy in jail who probably got arrested when he was like a teenager and be like, this guy, this
He
guy,
was. He was a child.
a serial killer. And you know, James Bond slash, you know, all rolled into one, all rolled into one.
There's a flashback where he looks at a gun, and I think that's the day he killed his dad. And in this flashback, he's like 14 years old.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
And they just knew. They just knew.
like, did he have to defend him? He must have met Mr. Miyagi in prison.
Maybe. That's the flashback we have to see in the next movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that whole setup is really ridiculous. I do want to talk about Chris Evans for just another minute. He, I found, was really great because I truly, truly despised him by the end of the movie. I desperately wanted to see him die, but he's also very entertaining. Like, he's very funny when he's on screen. So it's a very a difficult thing to pull off, and I think he did a really good job.
Yeah, he was very unlikable.
Yes, hateable, very hateable.
And an awful mustache.
Yes, which helped. That very much helped. Yes. So yeah, it was entertaining and dumb, but hey. That's what action movies are usually, so.
Yeah, it was, no stress, just something to put on and kill some time. I don't know if I'd like to be thought of that way if I was a movie, though. I'd rather be hated or like loved. I feel like I'd want to be remembered in some way with some sort of actual emotion attached to that. And this is just fine.
I don't know about that when you're saying that that's what you would prefer. The simple fact is, I agree if you're making some little personal project that you want to put it out there and see how it goes. If you want to see that type of movie, then go see, for example, Drive and Only God Forgives.
I saw all of that.
Go see movies like that because I like both of those movies, but I understand why people despise Only God Forgives. I understand it, but I actually appreciate that film. But my point is, if you want that type of experience, go see those films. If you just spent, no joke, they spent over $200 million destroying a whole entire city for this movie, you're definitely not going for, something that could be like, well, they could love it or they could hate it. They're like, nope, it's got to be something that everybody's going to consume and everybody's going to enjoy because
That was
we,
crazy.
yeah, it's nuts.
That was so crazy. I can't believe they went that far. I'm like, they
Yeah.
should be fired. They are not good at just zoning in on their target and efficiently getting anything done. This is madness. It was
I
like
always,
people and cars and houses and
yes.
bombs.
Oh yeah, Evans is the worst. That's why it makes him so despisable. Like the idea of that maximalist attempt to get this guy is just like that's all. And then he's all proud of himself because he got like that one guy to covertly follow them. It's like you needed to destroy a whole city to get that part of the plan in place. Like, what are you talking
But
about?
these are bad agents. He
Yes,
was handcuffed to a bench and they
yeah.
could not get him.
That's one of
They
the funniest
just
lines
couldn't
when he goes,
get
how
him.
hard is it to shoot somebody?
Who's handcuffed to one location?
To your point of how badly run that whole project is, he's not saying, here is a tactical stealth sniper on the rooftop who's going to shoot that guy at the park bench. He's saying, every one of those guys out there, I'm going to give you $50 million or whatever to kill him. And then he's like saying, whoever kills him first gets, shoots him first gets now another $10 million. Those guys they're equally vested in shooting each other than they are in shooting the target. So not a good way to go about this whole plan. So,
Nope.
nope. Speaking
But
of
if you
nope.
want to kill some time
Yeah.
and it's entertaining,
I mean, but
go
that's
for
actually,
it.
if you want to read any metaphor into it, I always try to like read something and say, whether it's intentional or not, it's the whole idea of the death of the author. That once you write something, it's open for interpretation and it might be something you didn't even know it was, right? So if I want to interpret this in any way, first of all, I think it's intentional that they're making him look like a terrible, terrible agent in doing this, ridiculous plan, and that's why he has such a bad reputation. But second of all, if you want to read the film as any kind of metaphor of anything, you could read the metaphor as like Netflix, which is spending trillions of dollars, creating all this content and hiring every movie star to make movies only for them. This is like the Netflix method of swatting a fly. They're like, we're going to destroy a whole city to keep your attention. So it's like, well, maybe that's what it takes. Maybe that's what it takes.
Crazy. So yeah, watch it for that.
You're hearing there in the background, I Wear My Sunglasses at Night by Corey Hart, a huge hit from back in the day in the 80s, reused here very interestingly in the movie Nope. And here's my conversation with my sister, where she's now seen Nope. And once again, spoilers, by the way, spoilers for Nope. Unlike The Gray Man, this is a film that really can be spoiled. So beware, spoilers, if you do plan to see the film in the future. Michael Abels has done all of Jordan Peele's movies. And he, of course, did this incredible remix of I Got Five on It from Us.
Ooh, I like it.
But of course, he like takes this is the mostly the original version, but he goes in. So he, rearranged that. But then in this Nope movie, I thought he did something really interesting, which was slowing down, severely slowing down. I Wear My Sunglasses at Night.
That was great. What a great scene. It made sense. It was moody.
And they have it here on the it's on the soundtrack.
It's fantastic.
But it's pretty pretty crazy. And very well, like you said, very well used in the film. I have my whole review, obviously, there and my analysis of it. And I honestly, I'm just going to do, you know, a brief moment here, but I want to hear mostly what you have to say. I was a little disappointed in the film as entertainment. I was very intrigued by it and all these different things that it was playing with, all these different themes it was exploring, and all this, like, you know, corollaries to other blockbusters of the past. That's all interesting from a cinemaphile type examination. From moment to moment, I didn't find it as thrilling as it could have been, although there are two or three sequences, I would grant you, in the film where I was grabbing my armrest, like very, very, very tense. But that's pretty few and far between. So what was your experience, and what did Carlos think of it also?
He didn't hear your podcast when we went. We just went to the movies. Yeah. And he turns to me and goes, "This is a Jaws remake."
Yes.
And then he would point out why along the way.
Yeah.
I thought it was really good. I thought it was almost like an art movie at an art house. I got that vibe off it because there was a few things happening in there. I liked that they were switching from one character's experience to another. They start with that really torturous scene with the monkey.
Oh my
and
God.
Then you see the son's experience, and then it shifts to the daughter's experience. Yeah. And I thought it was very well done.
Yeah, I think the first half hour of the movie was so intriguing to me for the reasons you said. The way it begins, we are actually seeing the creature there at the beginning without knowing it until the very end. Spoilers, everybody. I'll put that at the beginning. Spoilers for Nope. A film you actually can spoil. I mean, The Gray Man, we talked about the plot. I don't think we spoiled anything there because there's nothing.
It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. But in this case, definitely spoilers for this one. Yeah, the whole setup at the beginning, the father dying the way he did, it was like so sad. And you see that brutal outcome of that, you know, just that garbage falling from the sky and, like, you know, splitting it, you know, basically embedding in his brain. You know, the flashback to Gordy, the whole Gordy attack, which is so traumatic. It's like, you know, shocking. I was so intrigued by the first half hour of the film. I just feel that by the end, like the Gordy thing, for example, is very problematic to me because I feel like it's such a fascinating backstory. It's so incredible that this guy can't even deal with his own trauma, that he can only even answer the question by referring to a skit that was on Saturday Night Live. He can't even talk about the actual event. And he makes it sound like, oh man, it was so funny. But we see his flashbacks. It is not funny at all. It's horrendous. And so that's all really interesting. And then he just dies. I'm like, well, I don't understand what the payoff for that was, you know?
Yeah, he should have had a lot more focus.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I feel that so much of the film is unfocused.
But I liked it. You and Carlos are correct. It is a Jaws remake.
Yeah.
He kept, every time something happened, he'd be like, again, he'd compare the two. And this is all the way through.
Yeah.
I thought that was entertaining. To me, that's entertaining. Yeah. I was a little tiny bit disappointed when I got to see the thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I'm always disappointed when I see the thing.
Yeah.
When I go to a movie, I'm way more horrified before I see it. My imagination has something going on that when I see it, I'm like, oh, okay, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. This is manageable.
Did you think that this thing is extraterrestrial? It's obviously not answered in the film.
I'm assuming so, unless they want to go all into that thing where they're like, this is really all the garbage of the world comes together because it hasn't been recycled enough. And now they created a creature and it flies around, but doesn't want garbage and it spits it out.
I didn't mean that.
Somebody's going to analyze it like that. Yeah. I think it was, yeah, an alien.
Yeah, I mean, you could read it as a metaphor for garbage, for pollution, for media pollution. Yes, you can write. But I'm not talking about that. I was talking about, like, for example, can we just think about this as, you know how there are like certain fish, you know, these prehistoric fish that can only live in like two places on Earth, and they're like the last 100 of their species, and they're in some extreme situation, or something like an alligator, right, that has survived for 700 million years, like beyond like the dinosaurs and everything. or some of these insects also. So my point is, was this just like a predator of some kind that has been, you know, because supposedly we've been having these alien visitors for years. So is this just some predator like a shark? And like whenever you hear something random, like, yeah, something fell out of the sky, you know, and smashed through my house. It's just like, maybe it's one of these creatures. And it's just like, we don't see them. Because
or it could be something that was created, just this anomaly.
Yeah, it could be
something exists.
It could be some bizarre anomaly, right? Exactly.
But it could only survive like in sand or right. something, because it was only in a very specific place. That's where right. it was comfortable, I'm assuming.
Exactly. And this could be like an octopus, which is what it kind of correlates to as an animal, where it's kind of something that just like camouflages itself and kind of just sticks to itself, and it eats when it needs to eat, and that's
like
it.
Like a sky octopus.
Yeah, like a sky octopus, right? Which is kind of what it is, right? So. So that's my
question.
We'll
never know.
Is it nature or is it alien? And the reason I think they kind of correlated to nature, not only because they obviously have that Jaws reference, I also think that you think about the cinematographer guy who dies, that's what he does, right? He documents all these predators, right? So it's like, this is just another super predator that he's, you know, tracking down or fascinated by.
I don't think we're going to know, because I don't think this is something that you can spin into a two. So yeah,
no, unlikely, unlikely to have a second.
I don't know. We're going to know about as much of those other people out there. Oh no. Cause then the army comes and they'll probably analyze it.
Yeah, exactly. So they can't be crashed down to Earth. Maybe they'll start breeding them now and then they'll get out.
Yeah. Turn it into an airplane.
It could be.
We have these new jets.
I do like how they solve that problem, where it's like, you know, it moves in this very strange way. It's too close to the ground, whatever it is. And it's like, it's just like a sail, right? Just like flying around. And it's like, you know, too light to show up on radar. So I'm like, I like the way they solved all that. They obviously thought it through very well.
When the barbed wire ripped it apart.
Yes.
And it turned into this very pretty kind of kite.
Yeah, exactly. Did that guy survive? What do you think?
I think he spit him back out. He looked fine to me.
Did he look okay? I wonder if he got, you know, wound up in all that wire.
That's what I was thinking.
We don't see him at the end.
I looked at him and I'm like, he doesn't look bloody. Did this thing just ingest the barbed wire off of him? He looked fine. In my memory, I now have to go on YouTube and try to find that scene.
I hope he survived. I assumed at the moment that he had survived. The only reason I think back on it that he didn't is because we don't catch up with him at the end, right? You kind of have that moment, like the traditional Western, after everybody kind of makes eye contact. You know, there he is, Daniel Kaluuya's character on horseback, and, you know, Kiki Palmer making eye contact, like, you know, I made the shot, I got him, right? Which, of course, I got him. In this case, she made the shot twice, right? She shot him with the giant balloon and she shot him with the photograph, right? So, and you know, like, and there's that, you know, that moment of triumph between the two of them. But I'm like, where's the other guy? Like, you normally, like at the end of a Jaws movie, you have the guy like kind of pulling himself out of the water or running down the hill or something. You don't just say, and there's that dead guy over there, which is probably what happened, unfortunately.
It looked like he was fine. He's probably just, you know, sitting there with PTSD. And I'm pretty sure he doesn't yes. want to go near that thing. Yeah. I don't think he's chasing it down at this point. Probably like, oh, I'm sitting here in terror. Somebody's going to have to go find him later and be like, it's okay. Are you okay? Are you okay? He's going to be put in a mental hospital for like 3 months. But he looked physically fine.
Last night, I told a stranger all about you. They smiled patiently with disbelief. Always knew you would succeed no matter what you tried, and I know you did it all in spite of me.
I do very much like when a show introduces me to new music or reintroduces me to music, and what you're hearing here in the background is In Spite of Me by Morphine. Definitely a song that is heavily influenced by Leonard Cohen, an artist that we definitely need to discuss at some future point here in the podcast. This is a song I was not familiar with at all, although I had some minor recollection of Morphine from their peak success back in the 90s, a time that is represented appropriately here in the context of the show. And there's a lot of good music here. You have Mogwai, another electronic artist from the 90s, that are producing the soundtrack for Blackbird, this ominous soundtrack we've been listening to.
But the needle drops are also very good. I've included Battle Flag in a previous episode here of our podcast. This particular song was a new discovery for me, despite I had some familiarity with Morphine. And tragically, the lead singer of Morphine died on stage when he was still only in his 30s, and the band was still near its peak, actually. So kind of a career very much cut short, a band that maybe would have had even more success. We will be covering the finale of Blackbird next week in full detail. But I did want to catch up on the show and also speak about this episode, The Place I Lie, the most recent episode of the show. Appropriately enough, the needle drop here is Something I Can Never Have by Nine Inch Nails. It represents to some extent the mentality of Larry, the killer, here in the show, and perhaps Jimmy as well.
I still recall the taste of your tears echoing your voice just like the ringing in my ears.
Now, to just catch you up, if you haven't been watching the show, a brief summary of the show before this episode. No spoilers, really. If you haven't caught up on the show, I'd recommend this show. Show run and produced and written by Dennis Lehane, the famous author. And this story is based on a true story in which we meet Taron Egerton playing Jimmy Keane. And he is a former high school football prodigy who kind of peaked in his high school years, but still not really well defined in the context of the show. Eventually became a drug dealer and overall mobster of a type. Ironically enough, his dad, Jim, Big Jim, played by Ray Liotta very well here, was a police officer himself, and nonetheless raised a criminal son who actually was in business with his brother, so two criminals, potentially, in the family. And at the beginning of the show, we see that Jimmy has been arrested for not only dealing drugs, but also for having a huge arsenal in his home, a very big no-no. In Massachusetts, I believe the show takes place in Massachusetts. And to protect his brother, he supposedly takes a deal which is going to give him 3 years max, something like that. And they end up throwing the book at him, especially because his father is a cop, and make an example of him, and they give him 10 years minimum. While he's in prison, his dad has a stroke. And it also turns out that he's very good at making friends and keeping friends and starting a little side business of his own within the prison. So he's very functional in the prison itself and attracts the attention of a DA for his ability to befriend all these different factions within the prison population and can run this business right under the nose of the prison guards as well. So him being very good at manipulating everybody around him makes him a good candidate to offer a deal, a very specific deal, that he can go to a maximum security prison for the mentally insane, and if he can coerce a confession from Larry Hall, a real life figure as well, that he would be exonerated for his original 10-year sentence. Now, the tricky part here is that he's in danger every single day, because if anyone finds out that he's a rat, that would probably hurt his standing within the prison population. Second of all, his exoneration only includes his original 10-year time. So oftentimes, people who are in prison will commit crimes while they're in prison, sometimes just in the course of self-defense, which of course adds to their sentence. So potentially he could get caught up in a situation where he ends up committing some crime in prison, which would even extend his prison time beyond the original 10-year sentence. So this is a moonshot for him. It's a real gamble. But for him, it's worthwhile. First of all, he is a gambler. That's kind of the way he runs his life. And second of all, his dad, under the strain partially of what's happened to his sons, has a stroke. And he does worry that 10 years is going to be too long for him to be able to see his dad again. So he takes the deal. Once he's in prison, we discover quite a few things. One is that Larry, the supposed killer, has a propensity to confess to many, many crimes. He has a brother who, in many ways, is a mirror of Jimmy, a former athlete, a good-looking guy who had no problem betting women. And it turns out, beyond just a brother, that this is actually a twin brother of Larry's. And he was a parasitic twin. So basically, his brother was born strong and is to this day the fitter and more successful brother on very limited terms. He's not that successful. A normal type person. And you see that Larry has this inferiority complex from being born the runt of the litter, so to speak. And of course, something that over the course of the show, we discover that his dad reinforced, his dad being a terribly abusive parent. And these two men are in prison. They're like locked in this friendship, a symbiotic relationship where one has more information than the other and a hidden agenda. But over the course of the proceedings of the show, we discover that they turn out to have maybe more in common with each other than they first suspected. Now, if you have not watched the show, I would suggest, if that is intriguing to you, go watch the show and do not listen to the rest of this recap that I'm about to provide. Check the show notes. I'll have timestamps in there for specific topics if you want to jump around. But tune out here as far as Blackbird, because I am going to spoil up until this point what is revealed over the course of this most recent episode. And the most recent episodes, I should say, as well.
Do you have kids?
How was your week, Larry?
Just asking.
Would you describe it as productive?
I'm just asking.
And you've asked before. Several times over the years. And what has been my response?
I'm just curious.
What has been my response?
You don't discuss your personal life.
Correct.
But that's all that I discuss.
Because you are the patient and I am the doctor.
Can't we try, like, role reversal? Isn't that therapeutic?
And what would you say to me if you were my doctor?
Bitch, tell me your dreams.
I bet they smell good. Your children.
Early on in the show, it is suspected that Larry may very well be just a serial confessor and may not at all be a serial killer, that he's actually killed anybody. But beginning in the past couple of episodes, some of the stories he's told make us very suspicious as to his actual personality, although some of the creepiest things that he's saying may still just be performative. They may not be legitimate. But beginning with the creepiest porno stash of all times, as I've called it in a previous episode, a really repulsive porno stash of disembodied bodies that Jimmy finds in Larry's cell. But continuing in this episode, where it is made overtly clear that he has killed at least one of these girls. Now, there are certain things that I do not appreciate in this show, and honestly, there are certain things that I don't appreciate in a lot of these true crime stories, in turning the murders of these oftentimes women, oftentimes very young women, into a product. Like, I think of podcasts like My Favorite Murderer, a comedy podcast about serial killers oftentimes, and I just find it so utterly repulsive, this turning the death of real people into just entertainment fodder, and that the fact that people will seek this out as just thrills and chills. I do like crime stories. I do like when gangsters are, you know, fighting with other gangsters, because everybody's on the same page. I can enjoy that. I can enjoy a situation where everybody's in on the con and it's just a matter of who's the most culpable in this particular crime. But the idea that oftentimes these podcasts and these TV shows are all about these innocent women being butchered for our entertainment, it really does disgust me. And this episode does correct that to a large extent, because they spend a lot of time reminding us of the life, this girl whose life was snuffed out. And I, having a young daughter, this did touch me, especially towards the end of this episode, the idea that even this short life was a life lived, and it is actually a very touching representation of that.
I did the math. I lived over 5,000 days, over 135,000 hours. All that time was mine. You can die, but you can't unlive. I lived. Here. Here. And here. It was great.
And of course, it really makes you despise this monster who snuffed this life out purely for his own pleasure. So I do like that they have set these stakes in a different context. We have spent a lot of time, mostly men, on this show, although there is a strong character in the female prosecutor. But primarily, these are men talking about man stuff, whether it is Jimmy's relationship with his dad, who turns out to be kind of a jerk, who forgets to re-up his son's credit card at the prison so that he can continue to make phone calls. I mean, think about if he had an emergency and he couldn't call anybody, what a screw-up that would have been. And the dad could be partially forgiven for having had a stroke, but apparently they've burned through all of his money while he was in jail too. So they did find it very convenient that they could use all those hundreds of thousands of dollars he had in reserves during for his drug trade, and they could wag their finger at him, but they had no problem spending all that money. So he's not great with his parents. And part of this is what's kind of fascinating about thematically in the show that we're exploring this idea. Jimmy, in many ways, on its surface, had this ideal family upbringing, especially this relationship with his dad, but turned out to be neglected by his dad and abused in his own way, partially with this toxic relationship between his mom and his dad, and then having a toxic relationship with women in general. Of course, something that Larry also had, an overtly horrible, truly horrible abusive relationship with his dad, and of course, a completely toxic relationship with women as well. The difference, of course, is that he couldn't get women the normal way. He wasn't charming. He wasn't good looking. He was a little bit strange, just to say the least. So he preyed on younger women and murdered them because that's the only way he could have any kind of sexual release. So two sides of a different coin showing these different types of toxic father figures and two male predators of different kinds. Obviously, Jimmy is nowhere near the predator that Larry is. He's not murdering these women, but he is still using them in his own way. So all of this is very interesting. I have done no research, by the way, to see where they have added details. I do have a feeling that some of the threats that Jimmy experiences in prison may be exaggerated to create additional tension. And I have a feeling that is probably where most of the story has been fictionalized. But I've intentionally not explored the true story for the purposes of experiencing the show without that tainting the experience, since I do obviously plan to see it to the end. So tune in next week. My sister and I will be discussing the finale of the show and talking about how satisfied we are with it. And once I finish the show, I will be doing my due diligence and tracking down the real life story and getting a feel for where the show diverged. And once again, I'm always fascinated by adaptation, whether the changes made versus the real life story helped or hurt the storytelling of it. I'm starting to scare myself. You make this all go away. You make it all go away. I just want something. I just want something I can never have. I just want something.